Here is what we learned about Jeff Bezos. Like a lot of CEOs, he is really a coward, a bully, and a soulless individual. He can't face opposition. He wants to crush anything in his way, and he cares only about one thing and one thing only, money. And of course, the power that he gets from being the richest person on the planet. And that was the lesson we learned from Bezos turning tail and running away from the deal to build part of the new Amazon headquarters in New York City when people stood up and said, not so fast. This deal sucks. This is Jonathan Tessini, and this is the Working Life Podcast for February 27th, 2019. And a reminder first that this podcast, as usual, is brought to you in part by our major sponsor, the Amalgamated Transit Union, the largest transit union in North America that fights for the interests of its 199,000 hardworking members and promotes mass transit. It's also sponsored by the National Union of Healthcare Workers, a member-led movement for democracy, quality patient care, and a stronger voice in the workplace. And of course, as usual, you can hear the podcast on the Progressive Radio Network Thursdays at 6 p.m. You can find it on Spotify, on iTunes, and all of those fun places. Not only do we get support from some large supporters, but of course, our small financial supporters are as important. So please go over to workinglife.org, click on the podcast tab, and look for our link to Patreon so you too can become a financial sponsor of the show at whatever level you can afford. So what a hot mess in the aftermath of Amazon cutting and running from the deal it had made to build part of its new headquarters in New York City. And so, I mean, let's be clear, Jeff Bezos basically decided it's his way or the highway. He wasn't going to let community leaders and unions and other folks try to make Amazon a slightly more responsible company. And I mean, just slightly more. Nope. When you are the richest fuck on the planet, you are used to just crushing people. Ethics and morals be damned. Now, I gotta say, this is a classic example, though, of how easily politicians and the chattering media boneheads can be bought off and parrot the free market corporate line. It's really a case study if you looked at how the media boneheads, people who know nothing about economics, and their political allies just was spewing this idea that this deal that Amazon cut with New York City should just be left alone. It was just the greatest thing since sliced bread. So to unwind some of the truth and what went down, let me bring in Dave Mertz, vice president of the Retail, Wholesale, and Department Store Union, which was one of the most visible, active, and progressive voices in the camp that was trying to say, hey, the politicians might have sold the people out, but we want to have a say in how that deal is actually going to look. And now as we look in our rearview mirror, as Amazon has fled the scene, Dave, I wonder if we should start first of all with a little recounting for my listeners, because maybe not everybody picked up on this, that actually this deal collapsed just as you guys, and I say you guys mean the RWDSU, had actually come to the table to deal with the very issue of union rights with Amazon, something that Amazon usually doesn't talk to anybody about. So you actually were in the door at the table, and there seemed to be at least a framework of at least, okay, as Stuart Applebaum said in the press, maybe it wasn't very good. It wasn't the greatest thing, but it was a beginning. And then these guys pack up and just say, well, screw you guys, we're leaving.
Yeah, it was really bizarre behavior, to put it mildly. But unfortunately, I guess it's kind of like what we've come to expect from the ultra rich and the unaccountable. You rightly describe it, the conversation that we were having, you know, the governor, set up a conversation with us and Amazon and the Teamsters to talk about what, you know, worker rights might look like in New York City if they were working with us, you know, more cooperatively than confrontationally. And our assessment was it was a good meeting. So good, in fact, that the idea was that there was going to be a follow-up meeting to flesh out the details. And then the next day they split, turned tail and ran, which I caught us by surprise, caught a lot of folks by surprise.
And when you heard that, what did you think? Did you think that they were basically leading you on in this meeting, or that something else happened that drove that decision to leave, when in fact it sounded like, as we just said, there was some place to at least come to some agreement that would have removed at least one of the major oppositional points to this whole deal, meaning the fact that Amazon is a virulently anti-union company, and at least that piece, i.e. that they would be at least open to some sort of, not even card check, but some way that people could express their support for a union without being bludgeoned. What else was behind that, do you think?
Yeah, it's hard for me to really understand that kind of arbitrary behavior, because it really it does seem strange, right? Here in one moment, you know, you're talking with folks and telegraphing some kind of willingness to engage in a conversation about the concerns that we're raising, and the very next minute, you know, they're basically, you know, flipping us off and telling New York City to go to hell and leaving. And it really is. It kind of, in some ways, Jonathan, it goes to the core of the problem of, you know, completely unaccountable corporations that have the, you know, the ability to pretty much, you know, or at least they feel like they should have the ability to do whatever the heck they want, whenever they want. And that, how dare anyone even question what it is that they're doing? Amazon has significant problems in how they operate. I mean, it's been well documented throughout their operations, the problems with health and safety for workers, their disregard for labor rights, the impact that they have on competition. There's a litany of concerns, and we were raising these concerns and looking for some answers, looking to engage in a conversation. Thought we actually were in the beginning of that, and then I guess they decided that it was too much of an affront to their majesty for anyone to dare question them and engage them in any kind of like meaningful conversation about real world concerns. I think we've got a responsibility to raise these issues. And I would think that, you know, anyone looking at this would say, absolutely, if people have concerns or criticisms about a corporation or any kind of powerful entity in this country, we should be raising those concerns. I mean, we have a responsibility to do that.
And just to hammer that point home and circle back on an excellent point that you made, their behavior actually reinforces the reason for the entire campaign of opposition, because some of the proponents of the deal, certainly the political figures and some other folks, were saying, hey, Amazon's going to come to New York City. They're going to become this good citizen. They're going to drink the water. And all of a sudden, one day, they're going to wake up and be this great pro-union voice, or at least they're going to be okay with unions and all this other nonsense. And yet they showed precisely by their behavior that the proponents who were trying to go soft on them and try to sell the public and the opponents on this notion, hey, they'll be okay, were totally wrong and just completely off base.
Yeah, it's a ludicrous notion that they would come to New York City and all of a sudden they would have this epiphany and decide that maybe, you know, they've been doing things wrong and it's time for them to, you know, see the error of their ways just because they're surrounded by all these wonderful progressive people. I mean, it's completely naive. It really is. You look at the way Amazon operates around the globe, and in Germany, where the levels of unionization are beyond anything we could ever even dream of in this country, even in this city, and they still are completely anti-union in their approach. German unions have struck them repeatedly, and Amazon refuses to have any kind of a dialogue with the unions that would lead to any kind of meaningful representation there. In Germany, you know, where it's almost like a given that this is how, like, that corporations have to engage workers in a meaningful way. So it's like they're not willing anywhere on the globe. They are unwilling to engage unions and engage workers in those kind of discussions. The fact that we thought they might be willing to do something here seemed like it was a bit of a breakthrough. And maybe there was a moment where it's like, you know, we had raised enough of a din that they heard us and were willing to sort of, you know, maybe look at their behavior and say, you know what, maybe there is a different way that we can operate. Maybe we don't have to, you know, be like such a downward force on working people. Maybe we can do something more productive and cooperative with workers that actually means that everyone benefits from it. But, you know, it's like that didn't quite happen, did it? Now,
there is a positive aspect of this, and I'm wondering what you think about this in the sense that now that you've had this experience of trying to build this coalition for the first time, standing up in a very, very aggressive way, maybe not in the first time, at least in the U.S., there's not always opposition to Amazon. Amazon usually comes in, Bigfoot's a community, and people either lay down and say, oh, you're welcome, come, we welcome you with open arms, or they're just cowed and too afraid. But here this coalition, and maybe it wasn't exactly perfectly knit together, but there were various segments of opposition, whether elected officials, the RWDSU really led the fight on the behalf of working people. Is there something that other people can learn? Is there a model here that then can be carried forth in other places that Amazon does business? Or is that too early to tell about that yet?
No, I think there are very valuable lessons, and I think it's an incredibly important moment, and it's a powerful moment. And I, you know, something that we've always believed in the RWDSU is that, you know, we can't just have these siloed voices, you know, raising concerns about what's happening in our country and in our communities. It can't just be, you know, labor unions talking about workers. It can't just be immigration advocates talking about what's happening to immigrants. It has to be a broad coalition of voices that join together, because at the end of the day, so many of us share the same values, you know, of a more just society, of like, you know, of an economy that actually benefits everyone. And there's a place where we can come together and raise each other up and be advocating for just a better path for people, you know. And we've long done this in the RWDSU. I mean, we've worked with community groups and in coalitions, you know, for years and years. I mean, going back more than a decade that we've been doing this kind of work. And I think what the Amazon, you know, fight showed was that when folks come together, when we amplify each other's voices, even the wealthiest man on the planet, even one of the largest corporations in the history of you know, mankind, has to stop and take notice, you know. And we have real power. People have real power. And I know it sounds trite, but there's a truth there. And this really highlighted that truth. And I think going forward, it's going to be incredibly important as we continue to try to challenge the notion that it's like corporations should have unchecked power and the wealthy should be able to just, you know, make decisions for the rest of us without any accountability. We have to challenge that notion. And I think this is an important part of that fight. But it's a much bigger fight about really what is it that we want as a people? What is it that we should be doing to make sure that folks aren't getting left behind, that our economy is fair, that there's opportunity for all, and that there's a level of fairness and justice and dignity for each and every one of us, and not just a wealthy few.
Mm-hmm. And one of the areas that we talked a lot about, you and I did, and various people debated this, is this whole question of what's the proper role of giving corporations assistance and subsidies. And I think my recollection and my memory of our conversation mostly is that maybe I'm an extremist about this. I say no dollars to corporations, nobody should get a dollar. Whereas you think that there's a place, given the right circumstances, that taxpayer money could be used in certain ways. So explain sort of your view of that, even though, as let's face it, it's always evolving based on the circumstances, obviously.
Yeah, and that's a fair point. But I think, you know, there's sort of a general principle here that it's like, you know, there is nothing in my mind that is inherently wrong with using, you know, public monies, using tax dollars, using, you know, subsidies to encourage development and business growth. I mean, I think, you know, that conceptually is fine. I don't necessarily have an argument with that. What I do have an argument with is using public money for one, for corporations that don't necessarily need it, using it in a way that, you know, the recipients are completely unaccountable for what that money is supposed to be doing. It shouldn't just be a handout to enrich shareholders. It shouldn't just be a handout to help a corporation's bottom line. What these subsidies are supposed to be for is to generate, you know, economic activity in a way that benefits the people whose money it is to begin with, and that is the taxpayers, that is regular folk, you know. And what I think the best use of the subsidies is to create an environment where it's like, you know, you have a situation where you're creating good jobs for the people who live in the community in a way that is sustainable and responsible. I don't think the Amazon deal came anywhere close to any of that. There didn't seem to be any. I mean, for Amazon, you know, honestly, what the heck do they need our money for? You know, I mean, really, what are we talking about here? It's just a way of sort of, you know, bribing them, you know, to come here.
On your checklist, which are excellent points, on the first one, it would have failed on the face of it with a company that is owned by the richest person on the planet in human history company that is estimated to reach that's going to have a market cap in about a decade of $1.6 trillion. There's no need to hand money to a corporation like that, number one. That's on the face of it, it should fail the test.
Yes. And it's like, look, I mean, you know, they did their weird beauty contest where they were making, you know, cities sort of grovel and scrape and beg and bid against one another. And they did this because, you know, for no other reason than it's like, we want your money, you know. And I think we can do better than that. I mean, I would hope we can do better than that. And what's this maybe where I'm really naive. I would really like to think that the captains of industry, even in the tech world, might be able to hold themselves to a higher standard than just always trying to extract the most out of our communities and look to, you know, maybe do something that is beneficial for folks who aren't at the top of their pyramid.
I wouldn't say you're naive, but you're certainly an idealist when you say that. Because it's a great concept, but in the sense that the system doesn't work that way because. What happens actually is, and the folks at Good Jobs First, and you've worked with Good Jobs First in the past yourself, demonstrated actually that there is no actual reason or there's no actual give and take. Companies come in and they essentially, the problem with this whole system is that they don't actually need the money, but certainly they're going to take free money. And then Amazon is the worst case example, given the way they pitted communities all across the country. But this is what happens everywhere when it comes to these subsidies. These companies always pit one community against another, and it's really based on fear. It's driven on fear. Governments throw money at these corporations because they're afraid of being tagged as job losers.
Right. Right. And I think that's absolutely right. And I think it's what happened here. And it's like, you know, the enticement of being seen as like, you know, being job creators is, I think, so blinding sometimes to some of our elected officials that they fail to ask some of the, you know, more important questions. It's like, what is it that, you know, we're actually doing here? What is the goal of using, you know, public support for these corporations? What is it that we should be looking to get in return for this? And I mean, in recent days, you know, it's like there's sort of, you know, from the folks who are supporting the deal, it's almost like they're saying, you know, it was like, oh, duh. Why would anyone question this? I mean, it was obviously such a great deal, and it was such a massive amount of jobs that were coming in, you know. And it's like I get that shiny object is very bright, and it's hard to like, you know, see beyond that. But I think, you know, what we're asking our elected officials to do is to take, you know, to take a somewhat of a principled stand and to really look at what it is that they're doing and what is it the aim of the public monies should be, and should it just be a give out to corporations so that, you know, you don't end up looking, as you said, as like, you know, job losers, but you look like you know how to play the game? Or should you actually be engaging in these conversations and saying, it's like, look, we want you here. We want to be supportive. We want to look for a way to make this work. But we also want to make sure that whatever we're doing is beneficial for the people who are currently living here and whose money we are actually using in some sense to be supportive of this deal. And I don't think that's too much to ask. I really don't.
And I think one of the things you're now pointing to as you were talking, it just jumped into my mind, and I don't want to put you in the position of having to publicly, directly take on some political figures you may want to work with. So I'll do that on your behalf, but in a general way, meaning in the following way. One of the things that was clear about this is the lack of transparency, that the significant flaw in the Amazon deal and many of these other subsidy deals, to the extent you want them ever, is that they're almost always done in secret. And there's no input from unions, community leaders, other people who should have oversight. So these deals are done and then go sour, as 99% of them do, based on now studies that show no one actually reviews them. There's no actually criteria to see whether they've worked. And the fundamental problem is the lack of transparency. And that may be an important lesson we can push here moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, there should be some kind of an accountability, right? Within the entire process, there should be a moment when, you know, there's space for other voices to be engaged on some of this stuff, and some of the concerns around how workers are being treated, what the impact it will have on communities. These are real concerns, and they shouldn't be left out of it until it's too late. And I think that was part of the problem with what happened here, is like the reason that there was such, a broad outcry of concern around this was that there was no point during the deal making process where there were any opportunities for anybody's voices to be heard in this. So you're just being presented with this fait accompli. It's a done deal. If you don't like it, too bad. And it's like, well, no, that's really not how our country and our city are supposed to be. I mean, there's something to be said about living in a democracy. There's something to be said about, people having a responsibility as citizens to engage in these conversations. And the fact that that's treated as offensive to those who were proponents of the deal, to me, is deeply concerning as well. It's like, what are we actually saying here? Are we saying that it's like, folks should just, shut up, take whatever it is that, your betters are proposing, and that's it? That's not a kind of relationship with my, elected officials and with, folks who are in business. I that's not the kind of relationship I think any of us want, nor do I think it's particularly healthy. And so, I think you're right to question how these deals are done. I think, unfortunately, there's been, the disproportionate amount of power that corporations have in all of this has really put most of our elected officials, wherever they are, sort of in this defensive position where they feel that they have to play along with these rules and that they don't have any ability to question or challenge how this stuff is going on. Otherwise, they'll be on the losing end of these kind of weird beauty contests that corporations have been holding for now. It's been going on for years and years. This is just the worst example of it.
Now, more than a year ago, in January 2018, workers at the LA Times, The Journalist, and other media workers won a smashing union organizing victory, winning the right to have a union for the first time in the newspaper's history. And I covered that campaign, and you can check in our archive, episodes 63 and 66, to get that background. And we had that on the podcast partly because it was such a quite impressive victory to observe, an overwhelming victory at a place that had zero history with the union. And not only zero history, but the LA Times was virulently anti-union. It was an anti-union megaphone for decades. Since then, the union organizing core team has been hard at work trying to get a first contract. And as many of my listeners know, that's always the biggest barrier for workers. Once they've actually gotten through all the hurdles of the big test of actually winning a union election, because employers do everything to delay arriving at a first contract. And they delay as long as they can in order to frustrate as many people as possible who, obviously, once they voted for the union, they want to see immediate results. Now, on top of that, the biggest thing that happened at the Times was that it got sold from the company that owned it, which was called Tronc, T-R-O-N-C, to a biotech billionaire named Patrick Soon-Shiong, who assumed control of the paper last June. It hasn't all been a bad story. The new owner has poured money into the newspaper, which has hired scores of new reporters. And that is a rarity in these days, when usually the headlines that you've probably read about media workers is a sad story of cutbacks and job losses. What made me think to circle back to this story was an off-the-wall demand on the part of the company. And here, bear with me for a little, and I mean a small, tiny lesson in copyright law. If you work for a media company as a legally recognized employee under the law, you don't own your copyright in the pieces that you write for that media company. On the other hand, freelancers who are not employees of a company, meaning that they're independent contractors, they may not have the same rights as employees of a company, but under the copyright law in the United States Constitution, they own their copyright in what they produce unless they explicitly sign away all or parts of that copyright, which, and this is a whole other story that we can talk about someday, the corporate assholes in today's media companies have been forcing freelancers to do exactly that, sign away their constitutional rights in written contracts without, of course, getting much for those rights. But let's leave that story for another time. Let's stick with the LA Times. Because at least even as an employee, typically, if the writer didn't own their copyright, they could decide to create a different project, say a book or a movie script that grew out of a published story. But now the Times is trying to change all that. Which leads me to bring into the conversation Matt Pierce. Matt is an LA Times reporter and one of the key leaders in the union organizing campaign and the current negotiating committee. And before we dive into this really interesting topic of intellectual property and union organizing, tell me, Matt, what do you do when you're not spending hours and hours working for the working class and defending your fellow members? What kind of writing do you do, and how long have you been at the Times?
I am a national reporter at the Times. I've been there since November 2012, so several years now, actually. It's kind of flown by. But I cover everything outside of California and outside of Washington, D.C. So natural disasters, mass shootings, you know, basically the kind of stuff that you would see on the national nightly news when you turn on the TV. So kind of a lot of breaking chaos.
Mm-hmm. Mass shootings. Boy, that sounds like the great beat to be on, huh?
I can tell you that I've covered so many of them that unfortunately I've started to forget about them, which is a really sad thing about the beat, you know, because it's a lot of trauma and chaos. But, you know, from the journalistic perspective, what it means is that you're often in the middle of, you know, the nation's biggest stories and the thing that, you know, everyone always wants to know about. And so it's a significant beat. It's a hard beat. You know, you don't really get to develop a lot of sources. You're constantly parachuting in and out of places. But you always tend to be where the action is.
Mm-hmm. And before you were at the Times, where did you ply your trade?
I was a journalism student at the University of Missouri, go Tigers. And after that, I freelanced for a year from Kansas City, Missouri, which is where I'm from. You know, working for like alternative media, you know, it was 2011 when I was coming out of J school. So, you know, there weren't really a lot of opportunities out there at the time, but the way I got my start with the Times was there was a big tornado in Joplin, Missouri back in 2011 that killed about 160 people, and it happened to be pretty close to where I lived. So I just drove down there and freelanced, and I wrote an email to the Times and said, I'm going to work for the first place that called me back, and they were the ones.
Mm-hmm. Well, from a real tornado into the tornado of union organizing, had you been familiar with unions before? Were you a instinctive union supporter when you dove into this campaign? Because you became really one of the central people in this organizing campaign.
Yeah, actually, I had had no experience at all with unions before I became a part of the LAT Guild Drive. I didn't come from a union family or anything like that. I hadn't worked at any union shops when I was doing internships. So it was a completely new concept to me. And so during the organizing drive, this was something that I also encountered with a lot of the other young people in the newsroom, which is that they didn't have any experience with unions. They had a vague sense of what they were and what they did. But a lot of this, we had to teach ourselves along the way. It was more just a simple concept of we weren't happy with how things were going with the business. We weren't happy with the editing situation. And there were just a lot of grievances across the board. And we did kind of know that, you know, people who are in unhappy workplaces tend to use and not unionize. And that's the thing that people do. And so that's what we ended up doing. And so it wasn't really until we got into the process that we started understanding the intricacies of, the labor movement and what a contract might look like. And so, you know, we're about a year and a half into this process now, and we've been doing contract negotiations since about June.
Right. And we did have a number of conversations on this podcast about your organizing drive, especially with your colleague, Carolina Miranda, who was terrific. We talked to her before the election and then subsequent just after the election. And so maybe because I talked a little bit about this in the introduction and gave people a little background, give us a sense of what's happened in terms of the contract negotiations and where you all are at, and maybe what the mood has been since the election victory and since you actually began sitting across the table from management.
Yeah, the most significant thing that happened since we won our election back in January of 2018 is the paper was sold out of a publicly traded chain owned by Tronc to an LA billionaire named Patrick Soon-Shiong. He comes from the biotech world. He does a lot of stuff with cancer treatments and medicines, and that's where he made his money. And so he decided that he wanted to save the hometown paper because a significant part of our organizing campaign was about, look, the business model for newspapers is broken. You know, there's this thing, you know, obviously everybody knows about, you know, the decline in print advertising. People are changing the way they get news. But the other half of that story is that a lot of newspapers are held by these publicly traded companies that they're only thinking of their, you know, quarter by quarter investments. And so what that means is they're constantly laying off journalists and making cuts in order to stay profitable. And they're not reinvesting in the business in a way that would make it sustainable and to help us make a transition to the internet era. And so we said, you know, this is kind of messed up. We need to have some kind of future here or else there's not going to be an LA Times at all. That's around when Patrick Soon-Shiong stepped in. And so since then, it's been kind of amazing here. We've hired dozens of new journalists. Our newsroom has actually expanded by 25% since the sale. And since our unionizing drive, which is, I can tell you, an extremely unusual arrangement for a newspaper. And, you know, the strategy now is we're going to try to build a direct financial relationship with readers through subscriptions. And so from the outside, you know, it seems like things are going pretty well. You know, we're a news organization that's investing instead of cutting. You know, there's a lot of sort of good noises from management about, you know, having a public interest in trying to find a viable path to the future. But, you know, internally, it's a little bit different. And I think this is probably true for a lot of workplaces, but we still have problems with our situation, even though we've won the significant battle. One of them is we immediately moved headquarters out of downtown LA to El Segundo, which means that, you know, people are now spending much more time in their cars, commuting, and spending a lot more money on commuting. So it was essentially for a lot of people, it was a pay cut right after having the paper sold. We still had a lot of existing issues with how people were being paid in the newsroom, which we wanted to solve in this contract. And so we've just been battling over a lot of issues because, you know, there are going to be raises on the table for this contract. And, you know, we're kind of fighting to get those East Coast salaries that our competitors at the New York Times, and the Washington Post, and Reuters, places like that get. But we're not quite there yet. And also we have an issue with pay equity in our newsroom that's unsolved. So there are all these issues that are floating around that we still need like a union to help us solve. And, you know, which a new owner, you know, as well-intentioned as they might be, you know, they're not fixing it, you know, completely on their own. So we still have to fight.
So you brought up several issues. One is not insignificant moving people who haven't lived in Los Angeles. I did actually. I lived in Hermosa Beach for a while, so I know exactly where El Segundo is. And so that travel distance, given LA traffic, really changes people's lives in terms of how long they have to spend on the road, especially if reporters decided to live as close to downtown as possible. But one of the things that you brought up here, which I wasn't really aware of, is there seems to be, from what you're saying, a significant pay differential between the LA Times and other publications. You say, you pointed out the East Coast, the New York Times. What's the pay differential roughly in percentage terms?
I guess I would say, we're maybe talking about 20% less here in LA than on the East Coast, depending on what shop you're looking at and depending on, which pay scale you're looking at. It's hard to fix it to a rough number, but we are sort of at a deficit. And it's a weird thing to talk about, publicly too, because I'm trying to be sensitive to the fact that, there are a lot of journalists out there who are not going to be making, East Coast union shop salaries. But the issue that we're looking at inside of our newsroom is that we have a lot of people who get hired away by the New York Times and the Washington Post and, the big fancy places out east that, inside the newsroom we're often being told to compete with. And so it's not hard to look at those pay scales and be like, if you want to stop people leaving this newsroom, which is something that they want to do, then you're going to have to pay them better. So, of course, they have their argument that, financially, we're not able to sustain, these really big salaries. That's every company's argument ever. But from the employee's perspective, like our consideration is the job market. If the New York Times comes and calls, it's like, hey, Matt, we want you to be a national reporter for our desk. They'll pay me a lot more than what I make here. And so, it's easy for the company to say like, oh, well, we just can't give you money in this contract. But I'm not stupid. People aren't stupid. They look around and see they can make more somewhere else. That's the brain drain is one of the things that we're trying to solve for. And so it's just one of those industry dynamics that, we're hoping this contract will fix. It probably won't. I mean, the good news is there will be raises. There is going to be some salary leveling through, some pay scales that we're creating. And the experience scales that we're building actually stretch out to about 20 years here, which is great. Like actually a lot of contracts only go out to about 6 or 7 years for setting minimums for people, but a much longer pay scale, I think, is going to allow us to make a stronger case for more veteran employees to stay here rather than look around for the next raise. So that's one of the things that I feel pretty happy about so far in the negotiations, even if the numbers themselves aren't as high as we would like them to be.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so what caught my eye, and I've been sort of following a little bit your progression here in the negotiations, you all decided to make public this issue about intellectual property and the way in which management is trying to change dramatically the way in which they treat control over your work, and actually more not just your work, but your likeness and your names, the rights to use your names. And first of all, why did this jump into your sense that this was such a big deal that you had to go public in a much broader way? And what possessed them to actually, you think, lay this down on the table as a demand?
Well, this is one of those funny things about transitioning from not being a union represented place workplace to, having a union. A lot of this language, we realized, comes out of the employee handbook that Tronc had written for us. A couple of years ago, when they were going through their annual process of, adding new terms and conditions and employment to, our jobs at the LA Times, they just added in this kind of this very sweeping land grab of, basically any and all stuff that you even think about inventing or doing or whatever is owned by the company. And there's, it's like this very sweeping technical language, like any and all, and, terms like that, that are, kind of abstract, but kind of cover everything. And so when we sit down at the bargaining table to go through this contract, they try to codify this, or at least part of it in contract language. And we look around, we're like, this language doesn't appear in any other News Guild contract that we've seen. So essentially what they're proposing is to enshrine like this really aggressive language from, literally an employer that we hated so much that we threw them out and unionized over for being under them. And they want to enshrine it in our contract. And, the more that people think about the legal implications of what's written in this language, the more objectionable it is, because we have a long and
Do you think do you think this is ignorance on their part, that they simply just adopted the language in a wholesale way, without thinking through the implications, because their lawyers presumably don't come from a publishing media background? Or do you think explicitly they're trying to seize more rights and control more of your work and the product of your work than has been traditional in other places?
You know, it's hard to say. And this is one of the things that's funny about bargaining, because you can't see in the other side's head. And so you don't know exactly what you're thinking. And so when I look at this really sweeping language, and then I compare it with the past practice we've had at the Times, which is journalists write a lot of books. Like, if you're working at a place like the LA Times, you probably thought you got a book in the end. Maybe it's a book based off a story that you wrote. Maybe it's a book that kind of launches off of, tangentially the kind of beat that you're covering. You know, if you're covering criminal justice, you might get interested in the death penalty and want to do a book about that. And then we also have fiction writers here. You know, Michael Connelly, the famous crime novelist, started as a crime reporter at the LA Times, and he actually came up with the character Harry Bosch while he was a crime reporter at the Times. So this is the thing that I struggle with the company's proposal, because they brought in an intellectual property lawyer from LA. He's a very smart guy. He's, pretty distinguished, has a long track record. So he seems, pretty competent and understands what they're proposing. And we asked him if you're a crime reporter and you want to write a crime novel or a novel about LAPD, does that, fall under these definitions or these copyright definitions that they're proposing? And they're like, yeah, well, maybe. Depends on if it's based on someone you're actually writing about. So we saw that and we're thinking, if Michael Connelly somehow loosely based Harry Bosch off of, some cop that he met while he was running around as a Times reporter, the company could theoretically, under this language, control this intellectual property, which is now, a TV show on Amazon. So I think, probably from their perspective, they probably look at it and they're thinking like, hey, this is the language we have all along. It gives us really broad discretion. If a reporter comes to us and says, hey, we want to do a book or whatever on so-and-so, maybe we say yes. Or maybe we say, actually, we want to do that project ourselves. And I think that's a large part of it, which is that newspapers are looking for new ways to build revenue. And, this idea of like a newspaper that turns stories into movies is something that's looks like an increasingly viable part of our business model. We just turned our Dirty John narrative series and podcast into a Bravo TV show. And so, yeah, they see that they can make money from this. But our issue is, this language looks like it was cooked up in a tiny office by a lawyer who, it's like one of those end user license agreements you see on the internet where you have to scroll down through 1,000 pages and click yes in order to listen to your REM CD.
No one reads all those either. It's all in intricate language that I doubt a single person other than perhaps an academic or another lawyer would read every single one of those lines. And they do that intentionally.
Yeah, because it gives them as many rights and as much discretion as possible, which is what it's all about. And we're like, no, we want, affirmative commitments that says look, people here write books. They write a lot of books. Let them write books if they want. If the book is somehow based off their work for the LA Times, give them a, non-exclusive license so they can go write the book. One of the really kind of crazier parts of negotiations was the scenario that we discovered. If say that they gave us permission to do a book that somehow, based on or connected to some story that we did for the LA Times, if they give us permission to go on unpaid leave to write that book for an outside publisher, they still want to hold on to the film rights if there are film rights sold from that book, because they're like, well, they still think it's based on the original story, even if you did a year's worth of work, doing all new reporting and writing. And so they want to be the ones who make the movie. And so part of this is, intellectual freedom, our ability to contribute to the literary community as writers and creators. And part of this is about the company taking a stream of revenue for itself that, had previously been something that went to the writers. And so, again, this is one of those places where, they see it as a place where they can develop a business, but we see it as, for some people, they're threatening what's effectively a pay cut if they take away these, these creative options and these side enterprises that journalists have long enjoyed.
And as you point out, as we kind of wrap up here, as you point out in your information that you distributed, the odd thing about this, or the perverse outcome of this kind of provision would be potentially to drive people away from the Times, and reporters might see a potential project, admittedly perhaps risky. They want to develop a novel or a movie, and they might just quit the Times and say, look, I'm just going to go do this on my own, rather than have to go through all the legal mumbo jumbo of getting permission.
Yeah, and this is not just theoretical. It's I was actually talking to a friend last night who works for a totally different media outlet, but they showed me, you know, the contract that they had signed when they hired, and like their contract, it turned out, had similarly broad language, and they want to write a screenplay for a movie, but the language is so broad, it's like not clear whether their employer would own the script for, you know, this movie they had written on their complete, you know, own free time, and so now they have to have that question of like, should they quit their job so that they can, you know, safely own the rights to this, you know, movie that they were developing on their free time? So it's not, you know, it's not that theoretical. If this is Los Angeles, the movie business is out here. People write books. We run a festival of books. This is something that's a part of our lives, our professional lives, our careers. And so we just want some basic considerations from the company. And that's why we got a union to help us fight it.
And that was exactly where I was going to go. What's interesting about this is that I'm guessing, given the lack of unions in other spaces, in other media spaces, that similar provisions like the one that you're fighting now in the intellectual property are more commonplace. And yet there, in those situations where there is no union, an individual journalist that then has to fight on their own management and management's lawyers to try to get back rights or resist that. Whereas here, you're at least at the bargaining table. There's a group, you have much more leverage. And so have you gotten any reaction on this question of intellectual property now that you've brought it up at the table and said, no, this is not acceptable?
They have at first claimed that this is, quote, as far as I can go. That was the words of the attorney when we sort of presented our objections to this. But, you know, we're going to see, because we're going to turn up the heat on them. You know, we've gone public with this. We've had some news outlets write about our open letter, and they've written critically about what management has said about it. So, you know, maybe they want to rethink that. We've got a lot of subscribers in LA who, you know, care very deeply about what happens at the Times, who are going to care about the paper treating its writers well. We've got a book festival that we're putting on in a couple of months, and I can't imagine the company is going to want bad publicity as it's trying to announce, you know, and advertise this festival of books that, you know, people from the newsroom volunteer for. So there are lots of ways in which we can kind of turn up the heat on management to convince them that, like, look, this is a really big deal for us. It's a significant part of our careers. It's a way that, like, you know, we can make money that isn't just, you know, a newspaper reporter salary, which is not that impressive in the grand scheme of things. And yeah, I mean, at the New York Times is a first look policy where, you know, if you want to do your book based off of your, you know, Uber investigation, you know, you go to the company and say, like, hey, I've got this book proposal, and the company can bid on it if it wants, but other publishing houses can bid on it too, and you're free to sell it to the, you know, to the best offer. And so that's a consideration where, you know, the company gets a seat at the table if they, you know, want a chance to develop this story. But there's a consideration that, like, hey, you know, we recognize that there are these, you know, endeavors that people want to embark on that, you know, we don't really do in the day-to-day production of a newspaper. And, you know, we're going to let them do that as part of our consideration for them, you know, being happy employees here. So we also want revenue sharing if they develop a movie from one of our stories. Slate, the online website, just ratified a contract where they get 15% of the revenues that come in from any kind of a TV or movie project based on one of their original stories. And they actually just turned a podcast into a TV show. So it looks like that's going to be a first reach for that policy. Because, you know, this idea of derivatives, of getting paid for your work being reused, you know, it's very old in Hollywood. It's something that they've had, I think, since the 1950s. And so we're asking, you know, hey, if you're wanting to enter this entertainment space, you're going to have to deal with unions. And unions have standards for how they treat the talent who create the big home run projects. And so we expect that there's going to be some consideration for that for the hometown paper, too.
And now it's time for our Robber Baron segment. And this week, the Robber Baron of the Week is the CEO of UBS, the banking company, and his name is Sergio Ermotti. Ermotti's total compensation went up in 2018 to a nice $14.92 million, almost 15 mil, which is a pretty nice bump up from 2017 when he made $13.7 million in total compensation. And at the same time, well, apparently they were doing very naughty things. UBS was just recently fined 3.7 billion euros, and that's about $4.2 billion, for helping its French clients hide huge piles of money from tax authorities. And of course, those were very rich French clients. The bank, of course, is going to appeal the ruling, but let's be clear, this isn't the first time that UBS is fined. That fine, the one I just mentioned in the last few days, comes on top of a $780 million fine that it got hit with in 2009 in the US for doing the exact same thing, helping rich clients dodge taxes. Now, of course, I've always said in this program, giving fines to companies does not stop much because that's a cost of doing business. Until you put CEOs in jail for either financial crimes or worse, these kinds of behavior, that's just not going to stop because those folks are always looking for ways to make more money and get around the law. Until you start putting CEOs in jail for long stretches of time, this kind of behavior will continue. But this is not just simply rich people having more money. It's also about then governments having less money to help the rest of the 99% to build roads and schools and provide healthcare. These bastards and their banker accomplices are just leeches on society, greedy to an astounding degree. And so because of this huge fine, $4.2 billion on UBS for helping rich French people hide huge piles of money from tax authorities, the CEO of UBS, Sergio Ermotti, is the Robber Baron of the Week. That'll do it for this week's podcast. Thanks to my guests, Dave Mertz from the RWDSU and Matt Pierce from the Union Organizing Leadership at the LA Times. Our audio editor, as usual, is David Hebden. Thanks to our major sponsor, the Amalgamated Transit Union, and to our other sponsor, the National Union of Healthcare Workers. And of course, thank you to all the small sponsors who keep this show on the air. Do join those folks. Subscribe and support this podcast. You can go over to workinglife.org, look for the Patreon tab and click on that tab and support us at whatever level you can afford. Thanks for listening. Look forward to having you back next week.